Today on the 21st, Americans continue turning out to protest the police killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and countless other black men and women. We'll talk to a scholar who says while there is a long history of peaceful protest in America, violent and threatening demonstrations have been even more common. Then dental offices are reopening as coronavirus restrictions ease. But is it safe to go back? We'll talk to a health reporter and the head of an association of dental hygienists. And this May marked the third time in 3 years we've seen record rainfalls in parts of Illinois. We'll check in with a farmer in Menard County and the Illinois State climatologist about what they've been seeing. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Around Illinois, people continue turning out to demand justice over last week's killing of George Floyd by a police officer in Minneapolis. A demonstration in downtown Urbana drew hundreds of people, including the Urbana mayor, police chief, and director of the public health district. The protesters packed intersections and took a knee in solidarity with Floyd.
A lot of people are dealing with uncertainty and fear for the first time during the pandemic. We're out here in solidarity with people who live that every day.
That was CU Public Health Director Julie Pride. Thanks to Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines for that audio. In recent days, protests also took place in Aurora, Bloomington Normal, Chicago, Edwardsville, and Peoria, among other places. That also includes Springfield, which is where this voice memo is from.
My name is Sunshine Clemens, and I am a co-founder and the president of our local Black Lives Matter chapter here in Springfield, Illinois. On Sunday, May 31st, we just had an extraordinarily successful solidarity procession. It was estimated that roughly 3,000 cars and, let's say, 9,000 people participated. We chose to have a solidarity event in that manner because of the coronavirus situation and the pandemic that we are currently working through. Everyone, I think, knows that the Black community has been hit the hardest by the virus, and we wanted to offer people a way to still let their voice be heard and stand in solidarity with all the victims of the police brutality and situations that are going on across the country. But we wanted to offer them a way to do so that would make them feel safe and allow them to be socially distanced and not feel that they were putting themselves or anyone that they may come in contact with at risk. And I think it was extremely successful with 3,000 cars. We definitely underestimated the turnout for the event, and we had to extend our procession route on the fly to try to unclog some of the traffic jams that happened because so many people turned out. It's important to stand with your community through whatever the situation may be, whether it's lack of opportunities, senseless killings, systemic racism, a pandemic, whatever it is. You stand and you work together and you make the needed changes no matter how long that takes. You do the work. That's what Black Lives Matter is about and represents to me. And I think people have been receptive of it. I don't think it would be possible for me to come off the heels of a event that had 3,000 cars and roughly 9,000 people that participated and say that we don't have some support out there. It was made very clear that we do. There are, of course, those who are, you know, staunchly against what we do, but progress is almost always met with resistance, so that's not really a surprise to us, and it's not going to stop us. Our goal is to represent and empower the Black community in Springfield, as well as working toward fostering a better relationship with a variety of entities, including the police department. And that's our goal, and we'll continue to do what we can to achieve those goals, and we're always willing to work with others and collaborate on ways to achieve those goals with other organizations and people that have the same mindset and want to, you know, see the same changes that we do. It's going to take effort from all of us.
That was Springfield Black Lives Matter President Sunshine Clemens. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now, Professor Alvin Tillery. He teaches political science and African American studies at Northwestern University. There, he's also director of the Center for the Study of Diversity and Democracy. He's also the author of Between Homeland and Motherland, Africa, U.S. Foreign Policy, and Black Leadership in America. It won the W.E.B. Du Bois Distinguished Book Award from the National Conference of Black Political Scientists. Professor Tillery, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to begin by asking you about the way these protests are being framed. In the events in the last week, we've heard the words used to describe them include protest, demonstration, riot, looting. I wonder if you can just begin by talking about what do you think of the various ways we've heard the media and our political leaders framing what's been happening?
Well, I think very problematic, but also understandable. The reality is that when you have such pent-up anger in the face of longstanding injustices and inequalities, and you've kept people in stay-at-home orders for more than 2 months due to the COVID-19 pandemic, 40 million plus Americans being unemployed through the pandemic, by the way, it's not at all surprising that there will be property damage with such protests. Moreover, I like to remind Americans that we are a nation born of riotous protests. The Boston Tea Party, the famous event that is celebrated in K-12 education, was about destroying the property of those in power. I'm not condoning it, but what I will say is that the media needs to do a better job of understanding that this is fully a part of protest dynamics. I also think that to some extent, the media and politicians of all stripes believe that protests for racial justice will only happen through peaceful frames. And that's because of the legacy, the incredibly long and powerful legacy of the African-American civil rights movement from the 1950s and 60s. But that movement was extraordinary for the tactics that it used. It was the first time in history that anyone has ever won through those tactics in America. And it's not the modal form of protest in the American tradition.
I think that's a fascinating point because in some ways, as I've seen you say before, that's an anomaly to the America's long history. I mean, we learn in our history books about tarring and feathering, the British loyalists or the royal loyalists, I guess you'd say, in the Revolutionary era. The nonviolent, protest pioneered by the civil rights movement leaders was innovative at the time, right? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. It was innovative. It was borrowed from, the Gandhian movement in India. And it was done precisely because, Miss Rosa and Dr. King and, all the leaders of that time didn't want to happen to their movement precisely what's happening today. They didn't want property damage a few outbursts of violence to be the story. They wanted their campaign for justice to be the story. And so they put on their Sunday best and they marched peacefully with signs. And I like to remind Americans that they were still met with violence, intimidation, and threats from both the state and the ordinary citizenry that they encountered. So we like to think back on, why can't they do things in the way that Dr. King and his movement did things? Well, no one loved that movement at the time that it was happening. And this is the point that I like to make. Colin Kaepernick for 3 years has been excluded from the NFL for kneeling in prayer, a stance of prayer to protest these same inequalities. And the survey research that I do shows that people were just as mad about that as they are about property damage. And so that's a real problem in America that America's got to grapple with.
And, it's interesting because it wasn't just in the South and, Bull Connor and the images that are sort of seared in our imagination and in our history books. But I mean, in Chicago, King was greeted with pretty violent resistance. I wonder if you think there is a double standard when it comes to what sort of protests are allowed based on who is doing the protesting.
I absolutely do. And again, I thank you for plugging my very old book, but more recently I've been writing a lot more about the Black Lives Matter movement and social protests, and doing a lot of public opinion and quantitative analyses of these movements. And, you know, frankly, I think that there's a lot to be said about nonviolent protest. Nonviolent protest, like the Black Lives Matter movement had with that caravan. What they do is they focus events in such a way that you can control the narrative, particularly when you're a decentralized group like Black Lives Matter that doesn't have a national figure to drive the narrative. The story does not become about looting and others. You keep the moral high ground. But we can't expect things to always play out in that way. And the point that I want to make about the multiracial crowds of young people that we see streaming into the street is that, they're tired and they're fed up and they're angry, not just about racial inequality and what happened to George Floyd, but about the fundamental breakdown of our democratic institutions and our capitalist system. And both political parties, the septuagenarian and octogenarian leaders that are in power, need to be attentive to this moment when they put forward proposals for reform. Because what this means is that they're going to have to deal with that anger in the same way, and this comes back to your point, that they respectfully deal with the anger of middle-aged and baby boomer white people who go into state capitals like in Michigan or down to the Daley Center with long guns and Confederate flags to protest wearing masks in the middle of a pandemic. The media treats those people, the politicians treat those types of protesters with reverence. Let's try to understand what they're angry about. We don't really treat the multiracial crowds of young people or the Black Lives Matter crowd or ordinary African Americans and Latinos who suffer police violence. We haven't historically treated their anger about the system with the same kind of reverence. And that's where the double standard is, and that's what needs to change.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Professor Alvin Tillery. He's a professor of political science and African American studies at Northwestern University. You know, I want to return to something you mentioned a moment ago, which was, and this kind of harkens back to a tweet I saw over the weekend from a Chicago Tribune columnist who said, it feels like we're living through 1918, 1929, and 1968, kind of all rolled together. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about the context of what else is happening in a society when protests reach a tipping point. I mean, we've seen regional protests in recent years over the killing of Michael Brown and Ferguson and Baltimore. And I mean, there are so many places all over the country, but I don't recall recently, at least, this sort of as massive a national sort of protest as we've had now. And in the 60s, you had Vietnam. And now we've got this pandemic and recession. Do you think that what we're seeing now would have happened without COVID-19?
It may. And I do think the Black Lives Matter organizers across the country deserve a lot of credit for raising the consciousness of, everyone by making these videos, these cell phone videos of police killings go viral. And giving us a sort of slogan for focusing our emotions about that. They deserve full credit for that. But I do think that Brian, all too well, the dominant riot history in America is a history of angry white men streaming into places like the South Side of Chicago or East St. Louis, Illinois, or Greenwood section of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and burning the place to the ground. Tens and hundreds of killings. And those things typically happened in summer months when people were, sort of coming out into the nature for the first time after harsh winters and mixing more. you know, the Chicago race riot, you know, a black kid swam across it, an invisible segregation line separating white beachgoers from black beachgoers. And this led to a conflagration, right? And so we were in a summer. This is when these things happen. Mm-hmm. And like in 1919, we've been pent up with the stay-at-home orders. And that's part of it. But what I want to stress is that with these, unlike our dominant riot history, which has been a riot history to preserve the racial order, what we see here are multiracial crowds protesting for racial justice. And that's the flip that needs to go off, the switch that needs to go off in the minds of the political class, particularly in the Democratic Party, because these people are the future voters, the future dominant voters of our society. And that's why the Republicans behave the way that they do. They're terrified of these changes. And this is what explains Mr. Trump's stance toward it.
You know, if it's, and I'm afraid we've only got a little less than a minute left in our conversation, and there's so much more we could be talking about, but I wonder, I mean, you're used to having to, as a professor, explain things to large groups of people, but if it's not too personal to ask, how are you handling your emotions related to another police murder of a black man?
Well, I've been in this business a long time, and it's always hard, but, you know, I'm of that generation that integrated America. I helped integrate my neighborhood, integrated my bus stop. I myself am a lynching survivor. I chose this work because this is the work that I want to do to promote change. But the videos make it a lot harder. The videos are an assault on mental health. And it's profoundly sad when those videos hit our streams. But I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that these young people in the streets are going to make change. I'm just hopeful that the old people in Washington will give them the support that they need.
Professor Alvin Tillery, he teaches political science and African American studies at Northwestern University, where he is also the head of the Center for Study of Diversity and Democracy. Professor Tillery, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Brian.
More to come after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Dentist offices in Illinois have reopened for routine dental care. Since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, they've been instructed to limit dental visits to emergency situations only. But states and federal agencies have issued guidance saying non-emergency dental care can resume as long as precautions are taken to protect both patients and staff. That means screening everyone for COVID-19 symptoms and using the highest level of personal protective equipment available. But dentists across the nation are struggling to secure an adequate supply for protective gear, and that has some who work in dentist offices worried about returning. To learn more, I'm joined by Christine Herman, health reporter for Illinois Newsroom and Side Effects Public Media. Christine, welcome back to The 21st.
Thank you, Brian. It's good to be here.
Also on the line with us from the Northwest Chicago suburbs is Jeannie Bosecker, president of the Illinois Dental Hygienists Association. Jeannie, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So Jeannie, I want to begin with you. What have the past few months been like for dental offices across the state?
Well, I when ISDS announced that dental offices were staying open for only emergency patients, obviously that meant that my job was eliminated for at least a time here. So March 16th, I was laid off until I went back to my one office May 12th, and I went back to my other office today. So I was off for 8 weeks from dental hygiene.
Wow. Can you help us understand why did authorities decide that dentistry was so much more risky than other medical professions and put the restrictions on it? And how that becomes even more significant, you know, we're in the midst of a global pandemic. Why was doing dental work so dangerous for practitioners?
And thank you. I'm thank you for this question because a lot of people don't understand. Dental work is involving instruments in your mouth that have to spray water into your mouth. And then that mist that comes out of the mouth is mixed with the blood and saliva that's in your mouth if there's blood coming out. And the virus can be in that saliva in those droplets, and then it can remain in the air. And, you know, I don't think we really know. I've heard anything up to 3 hours that it can remain in the air. So I don't think we really know enough about it, but we know that the dental aerosol is definitely a big mode or a potential mode of transmission for this virus.
So you're working in there, and theoretically, if somebody is infected or releasing all these virus particles into the air while you're doing this work. So, Christine, what kind of precautions are dentists being asked to take in order to keep people safe?
Right. So both the CDC as well as state agencies like the Illinois Department of Public Health have issued guidelines for the reopening of routine care. And they call for several precautions. Protective equipment, as you mentioned, the highest level available. So that includes N95 masks and a gown. If that's not available, then hygienists or dental assistants, dentists are able to use a level 3 surgical mask plus a shield. The guidelines also talk about the using air filtration and other infection control measures, and also recommending possible changes to procedures. So to reduce the amount of aerosols that are generated. So this is something Jeannie could probably talk a lot more in depth about, but you know, the difference between using the ultrasonic machines that spray air and water into your mouth versus hand scaling, which is more like scraping the teeth with metal tools, which is less risky because it produces fewer aerosols. The guidelines also talk about screening patients for COVID-19 symptoms, as well as screening staff and limiting the number of people who are in the building at any given time, having people wait in the cars instead of the waiting rooms, and not allowing visitors unless absolutely necessary. So out of an abundance of precaution, because we don't fully know what the risks are and the extent of the risks, these are the steps that dental providers are being asked to take.
And Jeannie, are you comfortable with the precautions that your office is taking? Does it pretty much match what you're hearing from Christine there?
Yes. My one office, he does not have air purifiers installed, but for my particular two rooms I work out of, I bought my own air purifier just to make me feel better. Hmm. He is, you know, 3 or 4 rooms away from me creating his aerosols. So I don't think that we're mixing because that office is large. But the office I worked in today is a smaller office, and he does have air purifiers all over the place. So I feel fine with everything.
We have some audio from a dental hygienist, Alex, in the North Chicago suburbs, who says she's being provided with N95 masks, but she is concerned about not having enough air filtration units for the size of the space. We're using her middle name to protect her identity because she is afraid of speaking out.
I was told that I need to leave my fears at the door and carry on and act as if everything's fine. A lot of us don't feel safe going back.
So, Jeannie, I wonder, how common are Alex's concerns? Can you tell us what you've been hearing from other members in the Illinois Dental Hygienists Association?
Yes, I am an administrator for our Facebook page. So I see the instant messages that come in, and they're not always members, but they are concerned hygienists, and they are expressing these same concerns. And they're asking us what to do if their boss isn't giving them the air purifier or the N95 mask. And it's just kind of frustrating because I wish they would have a conversation with their employer before they come to us, because it feels like they're not having that conversation. They're just saying, oh my gosh, what do I do? I'm being forced to do this. And there's no proof that they're being forced, first of all, that I know of.
Mm.
I don't know that they have talked with their employers first.
For people who may not be familiar with it, I wonder if there's a power dynamic. I mean, the voice we just heard, Alex did not want to, you know, use her first name because she's afraid of speaking out. Do you get a sense from some people that there's a power dynamic there, that maybe they feel like, well, I could lose my job if I complain too much about the conditions?
Absolutely. Because of the way the Dental Practice Act is written, we have to be working with a supervising dentist. And so if, you know, he wants us to come back and he only wants to give us, he or she, only wants to give us this PPE and there's no other options, then a lot of us feel afraid to speak out or to refuse because they can just replace us.
Hmm. Christine, you spoke with the leadership of the Illinois State Dental Society. What did they say about this?
Yeah, so I spoke with Stacey Van Skoik. She's the vice president of the state's dental society and a dentist based in Bloomington. So she says that, you know, everyone, all dental practices, or many, are struggling to get protective equipment. And that isn't limited to dentists. That's really all frontline workers now, right? There are nationwide, worldwide shortages. So that's one of the reasons that the State Dental Society, as well as the Hygienist Association, I understand, is asking, you know, trying to advocate for the state and federal emergency management agencies to rank dentists higher on the PPE priority list so that it won't be as difficult for them to acquire the supplies that they need. And she says that, you know, the dentists that she knows are trying to do the right thing. They're waiting to reopen if they can't do so safely. And, you know, I did ask her about some of the allegations that I've heard that some dentists aren't providing the appropriate PPE to their staff. And here's what she had to say about that.
I'm definitely not in denial that there could be situations where there are dentists that do not have the appropriate PPE and wanting to open. And that's where we just keep going back to, you need to communicate with your employer what your concerns are and show them the research that you have to validate, to support your claims. And if you're uncomfortable going back to work, then, you know, just say you're uncomfortable going back to work.
Yeah, I will say that, you know, Alex, who I spoke with, she said she has tried to express her concerns and share her ideas. But, you know, as Jeannie mentioned, there's that power dynamic. It's ultimately the dentist has the ability to say what the final say is, right? So, and because there are so many unknowns and the guidelines are guidelines, they're not requirements, and they do offer dentists a lot of a good amount of leeway in terms of how they actually implement them in practice. You know, maybe some dentists are comfortable with a certain level of precautions, but the hygienists who work for them feel like they don't go far enough and they're concerned. That's what I've been hearing from people I've spoken with.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about dental practices. The Illinois Dentist's Office have reopened for routine dental care, but as we're hearing, some dental hygienists are a little concerned that maybe they're not getting the proper protective equipment they need. We're speaking with Jeannie Bosecker of the Illinois Dental Hygienists Association, president of that organization, and Christine Herman, who's a health reporter at WILL Illinois Newsroom. And Jeannie, I wonder, how do you feel about what you just heard there in terms of the State Dental Society's response?
You know, that's a good response, but I guess it's kind of hard for the dental society, and I'm not trying to group them, but for them to understand they're, well, usually the dentist is the practice owner and the practice owner makes the decisions. And I think that's where the hygienists are falling into. You know, the dentist wants to open and get back to making his money as soon as possible. And so, you know, oh, we don't have N95 masks, but we're going to open anyway. And it's hard for them to understand that you can't, until you have everything you need, you can't open those doors. And I think that's where the disconnect is. And I'm thinking that some of these dentists, whether they are members of the association, the ISDS or not, that's how they feel. Like, well, I need to open this office, so it's going to happen however it's going to happen. And I don't think that the hygienist has much choice in that. And I think that's the problem.
Christine, what does research show about the concerns about exposure to the coronavirus in aerosols? And I mean, how worried should people be that they might be exposed to the aerosols in the dentist's office?
Right, because this is a concern not just for the workers, but also for the people coming in for care, right? The short answer is we're really lacking in data to address that question. You know, many who are concerned about the risk of exposure to COVID-19, and we hear it come up a lot in, you know, in news articles and discussions about aerosol particles. There's a commonly referenced study from the New England Journal of Medicine that finds coronaviruses and aerosols can linger in the air for 3 hours. What's not clear is whether those findings extend directly to aerosols created during dental procedures. And there's a couple of reasons for that. When I spoke with Professor Purnima Kumar, she's a periodontist and a microbial biologist at Ohio State University College of Dentistry. She says that dental aerosols are diluted with water, and that can make them less dangerous. They're also screening patients for COVID-19 symptoms. And so it's not entirely clear if a patient who is asymptomatic generates aerosols in the same way that symptomatic people do. But here's what else she had to say about that.
That evidence is not available because nobody has looked for it. So absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
So I feel like that last point is really worth reiterating, that, you know, we don't have evidence that it's dangerous to be exposed to dental aerosols, but that's not evidence that there's no risk, if that makes sense. And some people might feel that with the precautions they're taking, the risks are low, but in reality, the risks can't be completely ruled out. There's no zero risk situation when it comes to this. Even the CDC has said it's still too early to know for sure whether standard precautions adequately protect dental workers from exposure to COVID-19. So obviously it raises concerns, and there's some basis for those concerns.
So just a few minutes left in our conversation. Jeannie, I mean, given all these questions out there, given all we still don't know, how are you advising patients and friends who are trying to figure out whether they should get their 6-month cleaning or come in for a checkup?
I have family members that want to get their cleanings, or, you know, they're due for their cleanings and they're asking me if they should go. And I just encourage them to call the office and speak with, you know, the office manager or whoever answers the phone, and try to figure out what precautions they are taking, and try to figure out, are they comfortable with those precautions? You know, I work in a very infection control conscious office, so I feel pretty confident that we're doing everything we can to make sure nobody gets sick. And our patients kind of know that. But if they don't, our office manager will explain that to them in terms that they can understand. So I would just encourage them to speak with the office and decide what they're comfortable with. If they want to wait, then they can wait.
And Christine, anything you would add to that in terms of, you know, questions that people ought to be asking their dentists based on what you've learned in your reporting?
Yeah, I would echo what Jeannie has said, ask what they're doing to try to minimize the risks. I would say that also patients can talk to their primary care doctors who are more familiar with their medical history and with, you know, their current health status, to advise them about the risks. Because there are so many factors. It depends on how, you know, how widespread is the coronavirus in your own community? What health risks do you have personally? And then also obviously coupled with what kinds of precautions is your dental provider taking? And you know, what dental providers really want to emphasize, you know, the dentist I spoke with and the medical professionals who I spoke with, you know, their goal is really to make sure that people who need healthcare right now feel safe enough to come through the doors to get those needs met before they develop into worse problems, before they develop into emergencies. And so, you know, ask the questions, talk to your doctor, talk to the dentist, and then determine what level of risk you feel comfortable with at this point.
Christine Herman is a reporter for Illinois Newsroom and Side Effects Public Media. We'll tweet out a link to her story on this topic if you follow us at 21st Show. That's 21SD Show. And Jeannie Bosecker is president of the Illinois Dental Hygienists Association. Thank you both for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Coming up after a short break, May saw record amounts of rainfall in parts of the state, and some of the Illinois River is still rated as a major flood. That's coming up in just a few minutes here on the 21st. But before that, we want to take a moment to tell you about a new way you can help us shape our news coverage. It's our texting initiative. We're calling it Text the 21st. Just text the word TALK to 217-803-0730 to join the conversation. The first question we're asking is, if you could go back to the start of 2020 and give yourself some pre-COVID-19 advice, what would it be? Just text the word TALK, that's T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730 and let us know what your advice would be. And as a reminder, you can always send us an email to talk@21stshow, or even better yet, tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. I'm at Brian Mackey. This is the 21st. More to come in a moment. Stay with us. Listening to the 21st, I'm Brian Mackey. It'll come as no surprise to most of our listeners when I say it has been a wet and rainy spring here in Illinois. After heavy thunderstorms last month resulted in swollen rivers, flooded basements, and fields underwater, Governor Pritzker declared a state of emergency for four counties. One thing is relatively clear. More rain seems to be becoming our new spring reality. For the past 3 years, the month of May has set precipitation records in northern Illinois. That's according to the National Weather Service. In just a few minutes, I'll speak with the Illinois State Climatologist, Trent Ford, about what we've been seeing. But first, I'm joined on the line now by Brian Sartorius. He's president of the Menard County Farm Bureau. It's a little ways north of Springfield. Brian, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me this afternoon.
So, Brian, you farm corn, soy, and wheat. Have you experienced flooding this year?
Yes, not as extreme as what our neighbors have to the west, but it has impacted my operation for sure here in 2020.
And when you say the west, I was just checking the National Weather Service page the other day. It looked like the Illinois River was still pretty high up in a lot of places in central Illinois. You know, I wonder, is that sort of flooding normal for you? What have you been dealing with in the past few years?
Well, that's a really good question. This year feels a little bit different for us. 2019 was a real bear. We are impacted, I guess, by all tributaries, but most primary would be the Sangamon River, which of course would dump into the Illinois. Mm-hmm. We have 200 acres that we're still looking to get soybeans into the ground, hopefully later on this week. The river's recessed. It's recessed about 7 feet recently in the last 10 days. So everything like that helps.
What have you been hearing from other farmers in Menard County and really statewide about what they've been dealing with this year?
Well, I think as a whole, there are pockets of good everywhere. There are pockets that have been challenging. So in our area, we're seeing replanting this week, a lot of replanting. So that's time consuming to scout your field and go out and make the decision on where to put additional seed. I have colleagues in southern Illinois that have hundreds, if not thousands, of acres left to plant. And it's not been as a devastating flood, but just continual rain at the wrong time. Things are about ready to work, and more rain comes.
Yeah, and there's this trickle down. Can you remind us? I know this was a big issue last year, but what is kind of the deadline for wanting to get something like corn or soy, which are obviously our huge crops here in Illinois? What would be the cutoff for getting that in the ground?
Well, it's really a preference thing, but if you want to look at some data, crop insurance has a kind of a hard line of June 5th. After June 5th, then the percentage of your crop insurance drops down. And then we move into soybeans, and that has a later date of June 20th. So, optimally, we would like to have, corn started to be planting in April and continue through April, have a little pause, and maybe plant soybeans. But some of that's being reversed. We've got technology now that is allowing us to plant soybeans perhaps ahead of corn, and results are positive with changing up that pattern to some extent. But again, it comes back to the preference.
And what kind of effect does it have on crops when you get this much rain? I mean, do they rot? Do they wash away? Do you have to replant? What happens?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what if we just take corn, for example? You know, it's a seed, so of course it's kind of like us. It likes oxygen. So it gets that from soil, and it, you know, it wants adequate moisture, not excessive moisture. So what happens to the seedling is it sits in the ground. If it doesn't start to physiologically start moving in its process, then the seed that has treatment, and treatment are really kind of like an antibiotic that helps the plant while it's in the soil. Hmm. You know, actually kind of get going and be protected as it emerges out. So what happens as the seed sits in the soil, it can really start to decay, like you would see leaves in your yard. So when that decay happens, obviously the seedling's dead. But the other thing that happens is the seedling can use so much of its energy just to get out of the soil. And when that happens, it could really be stunted for the rest of its life.
Hmm. So is that an expensive proposition? You don't have to get in numbers or anything, but I mean, when you have to go and replant or delay things like that, or does insurance usually cover that to some extent?
To some extent, there's insurance help if you have that option in your operation. But you have labor to go out and actually do the work. But at the end, you know, at the end, the yield could be reduced, and that's what we're all trying to do is increase our yield, shrink our margin, and our yield can be affected by how that crop comes out of the ground.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been talking about spring flooding with Brian Satorius. He's president of the Menard County Farm Bureau. That's just north of Springfield. Always good to talk to a fellow Brian. Brian, thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Well, thank you for having us. To your listeners, come and enjoy Menard County and thank agriculture. Thank you.
All right. Hope you dry out soon. I'd like to welcome another voice into the conversation now. Trent Ford is the Illinois State Climatologist. He joins us now via Zoom from Champaign, Urbana. Trent, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Brian. Good to be here.
So we've been hearing anecdotally from another Brian about some of what he's been dealing with. But are you, you know, what's the data say? Are we seeing more precipitation this year than in past years?
Yeah, absolutely. So the climatological spring that just ended, which will be March through May, the official numbers haven't been released yet, but it's likely going to be wetter than normal, given that each of those 3 months were wetter than the 30-year normal, as well as the longer term average. And when we look at longer trends over the last 100 to 150 years, we do see significant increases in total seasonal precipitation in spring, as well as total annual precipitation all across the state. So northern, southern, eastern, western Illinois, it's been really the most noticeable change in climate over the last 100 years has been that increase in precipitation.
Andrew, I want to sort of drive in on that point. The most noticeable change in climate has been the increase in precipitation, not necessarily that the winters are colder or that it's hotter than it used to be, but it's more rain. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And as far as temperature change is concerned, we have seen, temperature increases in the wintertime and the springtime, minimum temperature increases in the summertime that have been pretty consistent over the last 100 years or so. But definitely as far as a total magnitude, as we think of a percent of change from where it was just 100 years ago, the total annual precipitation has changed as a large function of the normal.
How much are we talking about? Like, I mean, is it doubling or half more? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, statewide between 1895 and 2019, the total annual precipitation in Illinois has increased by about half an inch per decade. And so if we think about the average annual total precipitation across the state of Illinois is somewhere between 35 and 42 inches. And if we think about over the last 100 years or so, we've increased that by about 5 inches. So it's a pretty significant percent of our total annual precipitation that we've seen that increase. If we break that increase down over the seasons, spring precipitation has increased to a larger extent than the other seasons. And so what Brian talked about earlier with the seemingly increased frequency of spring, increased spring precipitation and the impacts to agriculture, that's something that the data does support.
That's fascinating. And it anecdotally, you know, if you asked me off the top of my head, I would say, well, we're seeing less snow in winter and more rain in the spring. And does the data bear up, you know, what I've sort of perceived? Or
definitely for the spring, the increased rainfall in the spring is definitely something that we're seeing. And again, it pretty much everywhere in the state, no matter what station you pull. The snowfall in winter is a little bit more difficult. There's lots of reasons for that. Snowfall records don't go back as far, as well as snowfall being pretty highly variable. And so it depends on where you are in the state and over what time period you're looking to see about snowfall trends. But definitely for precipitation, we've seen those increased precipitation again in every season, but spring sticks out as being the highest change.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Illinois State climatologist Trent Ford about the increasing rains we've been seeing in Illinois every spring. So what environmental factors cause this increase in precipitation?
Sure. So, precipitation as it falls is driven by the atmospheric condition in which it falls. However, when we look over a climatological period, that sort of long-term change that I talked about is driven by longer-term changes in atmospheric characteristics. So, the long.
Yeah, what does that mean for those of us who are not meteorologists?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So when we think about what drives precipitation, it's what we can consider the thermodynamic driver, which is the temperature in the air and the water vapor holding capacity of the air, if you will. So warmer air can, quote unquote, hold more water vapor. And therefore, with increased temperature, we have more water vapor in the air. That's kind of the thermodynamic driver, if you will. The other part of the dynamic driver is atmospheric circulation. So changes in atmospheric circulation can make it more or less likely that we get the types of systems, the low pressure systems, the mid-latitude cyclones, the kind of small scale convective storms that we saw over the last couple of weeks, more frequently passing through the state. So those two things together combine to make, along with long-term variability driven by things like Pacific and Atlantic sea surface temperature variability, combine to make that sort of long-term trend that we've observed across the state.
Could this mean more severe weather too, like thunderstorms and tornadoes?
You know, it, similar to the snowfall and the snowstorm issue, you know, we can track the frequency of tornadoes and severe thunderstorms. However, because those are more extreme events, the records don't go back as far, as well as it's more difficult to fingerprint or attribute climate change to any sort of variability or long-term change in something like tornadoes than it is in something like annual or spring total precipitation.
Yeah. So, I mean, both on the micro sense, are we going to see more rain into the summer this year to the extent you can forecast that? And then is this our new normal for, are we just going to be a wetter state than we've been in the past?
Well, you know, we do actually get our quote unquote new normals at the end of this year. NOAA will recalculate our 30-year normals to go from the 1991 to 2020 period. And it's likely that the total spring precipitation over that 30-year period is going to be much higher than it was over our previous normal, which was 1981 to 2010. So in that case, yes, we will see a new normal for the state, meaning that everything that we see from now to the end of 2030 will be compared to that average. And as far as the summertime is concerned, the outlooks were just released from the Climate Prediction Center for June, showing actually slightly elevated chances of below normal precipitation. So hopefully folks throughout the state can get a little bit of a reprieve from those wet conditions. However, driven mostly by long-term trends, the summer outlooks for June through August are still showing elevated outlooks of elevated chances of above normal precipitation. So hopefully if we get a relatively warm, somewhat dry month in June, that can help agriculture along.
So this is kind of a big question, and I'm sorry, I'm going to ask it with only about 30 seconds left here, but what should we be doing to adapt to this new reality?
You know, reducing vulnerability. Whatever that means for folks who are being impacted by this, if that means better drainage systems for urban areas so we get less flash flooding, especially in vulnerable communities,
If that means soil and water management or conservation strategies for agriculture, really the adaptation and then the mitigation of climate change and its impacts are really up to the folks who are being impacted by that and the choices they need to make to improve their livelihoods. But certainly, you know, adaptation strategies can help reduce overall vulnerability or increase resilience to the extreme precipitation and the flooding that we've been talking about.
Trent Ford is the Illinois State Climatologist. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Hey, thanks, Brian. Always good to be on.
That is all the time we have for today. You can always stay up to date with us on Twitter at 21stshow. You should also subscribe to our podcast. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One, anywhere you want to find us. Just search for The 21st. Our program is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.